I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. With the emergence of the Me Too movement has come the societal reckoning that sexual misconduct and assault is a pervasive and long-ignored aspect of our culture. Today we'll talk with two silence breakers from Kansas and Missouri about what it took for them to be able to come forward with their stories and to finally be heard. Then we know that stress isn't good for anyone, but it can be particularly toxic for kids. We'll learn about the long-term implications of a youth spent in tense environments, and we'll find out about a new program that teaches parents the most effective ways to engage a distressed child. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus calls them the Silence Breakers. They are two women who faced down an egregious case of sexual harassment in the Kansas State House in one instance and a horrendous gang rape in the second. Both women were determined to see their situations through and to not back down. And both did exactly that. Now a chance to meet two courageous women who will be honored Wednesday by the caucus at the group's annual Trailblazers celebration. They are Abby Hodgson, worked for the House Minority Leader in Topeka when she learned that interns were being asked to serve as designated drivers for male lawmakers who have been drinking. Now she works for a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., and she joins us this morning from NPR Studios there. Abby, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be with you.
Taylor Herr survived a brutal series of rapes in 2016 at her home in Independence. She also was a victim of sexual harassment when she worked at the Missouri Capitol in the office of former State Senator Paula Voda, who later resigned amid accusations of harassment and retaliation. Taylor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
Taylor, how difficult has it been for you to open up about these extraordinarily difficult chapters in your life?
In the beginning, it was very difficult. It took a lot of getting used to having, you know, reporters blow up your phone and leave their calling cards tucked in your doorway and calling coworkers. And I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, publicity that's not really good publicity mm-hmm. when you're involved in this kind of case. So taking all of that and getting used to that has been kind of a struggle. But the more I speak out and the more I meet people, I realize it's really a big epidemic, and it's really important that I'm out there speaking because yeah. I'm reaching a lot of people.
Abby, I'm wondering about you because I don't think it's a stretch to say that you put your career on the line over in Topeka.
Yeah, you know, it was difficult. I felt like I had elevated a number of issues to leadership, and those issues had been continually ignored and dismissed and not taken seriously. And luckily, because of my move to DC, there was a little bit more distance. And so I felt like there was the time and the space with the Me Too movement to speak out more publicly about what I had experienced and about leadership's lack of appropriate response to those situations.
Yeah, we'll talk more about exactly what happened in a few moments here. Taylor, when you talked to me for a Kansas City Star article about your struggles in Senator Lavoda's office, did you feel you were putting your career in jeopardy?
By then, I had distanced myself from politics because of my experience. So it wasn't so much my career that I was concerned about. It was mostly just my reputation as a, you know, citizen of Kansas City, I guess.
Right, right.
It wasn't as difficult a choice as it would have been had I come forward when the incidents were happening.
You know, you said about the violent encounter at your home a couple of years ago that even in the midst of that act, you told yourself that these men were messing with the wrong woman. And I'm wondering, even in a moment like that, how did that thought manage to cross your mind?
I mean, part of it was just self-preservation and trying to make sure that I wasn't thinking about the possibility that me and my daughter would end up dead that night.
Because your daughter was right next to you.
She was right next to me, yeah. I just had to keep thinking positive. And that was one of the things that kind of pushed me through was, I'm going to fight this. This is not okay.
So I'm wondering, you know, after that attack, what resources were you able to get access to that maybe some survivors might not know a whole lot about?
MOXA definitely has been
Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Abuse.
Yeah, that's right. They've been a huge support system for me. Also, just my friends. I'm very active in local Democratic politics, and the women there are very progressive, so they believe me, you know, at the outset, and having their support and knowing that people believe me was essential. But yeah, MOXA responded to the hospital that night. They were there from the beginning. They've been there for interviews and follow-ups and phone calls and anything I've needed. So
people were there to literally hold your hand through the whole thing.
Yes, quite literally, yes.
And that's pretty important stuff.
So important.
Abby, tell us how you became aware about this situation in the Kansas State House where, as I mentioned in the opening, female interns were being asked to serve as designated drivers for Democratic lawmakers who had been drinking. I mean, what a difficult situation to put those young women in. How did you become aware of it?
Absolutely. I was chief of staff at the time, and there
was... To the House Minority Leader, right?
Correct, mm-hmm. correct. There was an intern in my office talking about a dinner event that was to take place that evening that I would be attending, and she mentioned that she would be going as well, that she would be serving as a designated driver for a couple of legislators. And I said, whoa, hold on a minute. Excuse me?
Yeah.
And she indicated that she and a number of other interns had fulfilled this role previously for these legislators. And, you know, red flags immediately went up in my head, both for these young women and the precarious position that this put them in, but then also for the legislators, that this was not responsible behavior on their part. So I immediately took the issue to my boss, the minority leader, Representative Tom Burrows at the time.
He's a Kansas City Democrat, by the way. And he said what to you about that, Abby?
I asked him if he was going to handle this, and he said no, that he wasn't going to do anything about it. At which point in time I asked him if I could, and he did give me permission to address this further.
What did you do?
So I went immediately to those legislators, and I made it clear that these young women were here for an educational experience and that it was inappropriate and unacceptable for them to serve as designated drivers and that that would no longer be taking place. I received pushback from those legislators. They did not believe that it was within my role or my right to tell them how they could or could not use their interns, that they intended to circumvent me and continue to do so if they desired to do that. The issue was then elevated to a larger leadership team meeting, again, of which I didn't feel the issue was taken seriously, that I was treated with respect or that there was concern for the intern or the positions that they were being put in.
What year was this?
Oh, this would have been in 2016.
So not that long ago.
No, yeah. Not that long ago.
You said at one point in rereading the articles about this last night that you were threatened. What happened?
Absolutely. After this incident, I met one-on-one with a particular legislator who told me that I needed to watch my back, that I had overstepped, that I was out of bounds, that I didn't know what I was doing, that I just needed to, watch my back and be aware of what I was doing because they had their eyes on me.
You had one ally in the caucus who really stepped forward. Who was that?
I did. I felt that Representative Ed Trimmer really understood the magnitude of the issue.
From down in Winfield, right?
Yes, and was very respectful in dealing with the issue. And also Representative John Wilson from Lawrence was a strong ally.
So how did all this wind up getting resolved then?
I would say that it was never resolved. I made clear to the interns that they should not perform that duty if asked, and that they should direct the legislators to me again, ask them to perform as designated drivers. But to my knowledge, leadership never made any clear rules for legislators about the use of interns.
What was how long did you stay in the legislature then? Did that cause you to want to leave or to leave?
You know, that was certainly one of many factors that contributed to a work environment that I didn't feel was productive. After that conversation, I had a very serious conversation with my boss about that work environment and how I didn't feel respected, and set forth a number of things that I would like to see changed about that work environment, at which point in time he told me none of those things were going to change, that I could stay or I could leave, but that the situation was going to remain the same.
How did you manage to stand tall, Abby, you know, through this whole thing and then continue to press your case that something was very wrong inside your caucus at that time?
You know, I think it's really about the other women and their experience. I felt like I could say no and I could stand up to legislators and that there might be repercussions, but I felt comfortable and confident in doing so. But I recognized that not every woman was in that same position or would have that same level of confidence. And that really concerned me, that there were legislators who would take things too far with other women in the Capitol building. And I wanted to make sure that I could be their voice and their advocate and that they knew they had an ally that would fight for them, even if leadership wasn't willing to do that.
What's the enduring lesson in all this for you?
You know, I don't think we've come out the other side. I think I still remain very disappointed by members of our party and their unwillingness to address what's really a systemic issue in the Capitol. We have not seen policy change, and I believe that many, many bad behaviors still continue in the Capitol building today. So I continue to encourage women who come to me with their stories to find avenues to promote change that they're comfortable with and that they feel are safe.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking to two silence breakers who are being honored this week by the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus. In fact, they'll be honoring Taylor and Abby on Wednesday evening for their trailblazing work. More information can be found on the caucus's website. We just heard Abby Hodgson's story about her work inside the Topeka State House. I want to go back to Taylor Hirth here, because you were for the House Democratic leader in 2010 when you too became the victim of sexual harassment over there, Taylor.
Yeah.
Paula Voda at the time was the Democratic leader, much as was the case with Abby's situation. You've talked about a series of unwelcome propositions from LaVota through a barrage of late-night text messages, and you said he just wouldn't leave it alone. How did you work your way through that?
I mean, at first, I doubted myself. I thought I was making a big deal out of nothing, that he was just being awkward and friendly.
Yeah.
And it just kept progressing to, do you like me? Are we friends? Are we good friends? To one night he texted me and invited me over, and I asked who all is over there, and he said it's just me, and indicated that there was alcohol. And I told him, well, I don't, you know, usually make a habit out of drinking alone with married men. And he said, well, if you ever have any have a change of heart, come on over.
And these were all in text messages that
yeah,
you later turned over. Yeah,
I did. I mm-hmm. saved them at the time. I saved them in a political scrapbook I had been keeping, just because if for some reason some kind of accusation came against me, I wanted to be able to back myself up and say, no, I was not a party to this. So
of course, at the same time, you're navigating two situations, your work in the office and then mm-hmm. your relationships with your boss, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, he kept at it, making these overtures until you finally shut him down one night and quit responding to his texts. How did things change for you in the office after that?
I stopped getting assigned to follow certain legislation that I was interested in. I stopped getting invited to events. I was kind of the butt of his snark, and just kind of shut out of a lot of the intern activities. And thankfully, I had a great chief of staff and assistants in the office that still made my experience there worthwhile. But
And you were an intern at the time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Going to school where?
I was going to UMKC.
Yeah.
They don't have an intern program for interns that go to Jeff City. So it was something that I was paying for out of student loans and out of my own pocket. So it was something that I had invested in. So there was also the fear that if I lose this internship, I'm losing a lot of money as well. You don't want to get downgraded from the minority leader's office to just a regular legislator either. So there's that aspect of, you know, losing the credentials on your resume and losing possible networking opportunities. There's just so much that was at stake.
You know, some might wonder why you didn't shut him down sooner.
I wanted to maintain the learning experience, and I thought maybe if I was nice and if I was kind in, you know, rejecting, that it wouldn't escalate and that I could keep it at a minimum. You see with the school shooting, everybody's talking about the girl who stood up and said, told the school shooter that she was not interested in dating him. And everybody, you know, I'm hearing a lot of people saying that, well, she should have been nicer and she should have not, you know, done something publicly to shame him and maybe she'd still be alive. It's that sort of thing. This idea that women need to be nicer. It's no, you need to respect our boundaries. When we say no, we mean no. Quit pursuing us.
Yeah, right. You know, a special prosecutor has been appointed to look into allegations that Governor Eric Greitens sexually abused and harassed a woman that he was having an affair with. But this woman was dragged into this controversy by her ex-husband. You know, it wasn't something that she reported, at least initially herself. Yeah. She spoke out last night in a St. Louis TV interview. And I'm wondering, Taylor, what are your thoughts on her being forced into involvement here and how she's been treated throughout this process? Because I think it's fair to say that the media has not publicly identified her. Even last night on television, she was behind a curtain or a partition of some kind. What do you make of it all?
You know, I think it sets a really concerning precedent that, you know, an ex-husband can come forward with the tape and suddenly you're dragged into, you know, this legal case and forced to give testimony and tell, you know, this really intimate detail about your life to the public.
Again, the ex-husband surreptitiously taped her talking about this and then turned those recordings over to reporters later on.
Yeah, it's just an issue of, you know, re-traumatizing a victim over and over again by forcing her to tell her story when she's not ready or she doesn't want to. And yeah.
Abby, what do you think about that?
You know, just as consent is important in a relationship, I think it's equally as important when someone is telling their story, and you should be able to tell your story in your way, on your own time, when you're ready. And I think it's very concerning that a man would put her in that position again after she'd already been victimized once by Governor Greitens.
You know, I'm wondering, as we wind up this conversation, have we turned a corner in this country through the Me Too movement when it comes to women's empowerment and standing up the way you two have? Taylor, I get the impression from what you've said here today that, and maybe you too, Abby, that maybe we haven't.
I think we're starting. I think we're at a good place where things are starting to change, you're starting to see movement. But I think that the people who are in power are still, you know, the ones that are in charge of making change. And until it's, you know, more women in power, I think there's safety in numbers. And that's what's going to really, I think, drive home the Me Too movement, is starting to get women in positions of power.
Abby, yeah. You were saying a few minutes ago that maybe not much has changed in Topeka, and that's a little discouraging to hear after all of this.
Right. I believe that we need a fundamental cultural shift in Topeka. And I think the conversation has started, but I don't think we're anywhere near being finished. And I hope that it's one that continues over the course of the summer and that we don't allow ourselves to be distracted by other important issues. You know, education and the Supreme Court ruling, is happening right now. And that's incredibly important. But we can't lose sight of the other important issues such as this one.
What more needs to happen, Abby, in your view, to empower women to stand up?
I think women need to feel supported when they stand up. I think there need to be more allies in the room who say that they believe them, that they support them, and who are willing to take action on their behalf when women come forward with issues.
How about you, Taylor?
I agree.
Hard to argue with that.
Yeah, definitely. We just need people who are going to stand up and speak up and believe. I think one of the people always find it strange, but one of my kind of safe spaces is the internet comment section after people post news articles, because you have a whole bunch of people and they're victim blaming and, you know, really showing how rape culture is still so prevalent. But then you also have the people in there that are speaking up and countering their arguments and saying, no, you know, this is wrong and this needs to change. And the more people I see speaking up and saying these things, it's what gives me hope that there really is starting to be a cultural change. And so, yeah.
I was going to say, the fact that the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus is honoring you says something in and of itself, doesn't it? Yeah. Big moment.
Yeah. I'm very honored.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. Again, our two guests will be honored Wednesday evening for their trailblazing work. More information about that can be found on the website of the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus. Again, we were joined today by Taylor Hirth, who once worked in the office of Missouri Senator Paul Lavoda. Abby Hodgson worked for the House Minority Leader over in Topeka. Thank you both for sharing your very powerful stories. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us,
Steve.
Best of luck to both of you. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about an innovative program in Kansas that helps young kids who have been traumatized and how to work them through that kind of difficult trauma. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we looked at what Missouri lawmakers accomplished and what they didn't during the chaotic legislative session that ended last week. You can hear that conversation and so many others. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll speak to mental health professionals about ways to help teens who are dealing with stress, anxiety, and depression. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, too much stress for a baby can be toxic, and now a new project underway in Kansas is taking aim at this problem. Project NeuroNurture is investigating $2.4 million to serve disadvantaged families over a three-year period through five pilot sites around the state. The key is to regulate elevated infant toddler cortisol levels. With us to talk about Project NeuroNurture is Amy Mendenhall. She's the principal investigator for the program, and she joins us by Skype this morning. Amy, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Hart is here with the studio in the studio with me. She's with Project Eagle Home Visitor. That's based in Wyandotte County. Katie, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Katrina Lowry works with this program in Garden City on the western Kansas, and she joins us via Skype. Katrina, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. It's nice to be here.
Amy, what is Project NeuroNurture? What's the aim here?
Well, the aim of Project NeuroNurture is really to help families in Kansas, families with young children in Kansas, help their children to be successful, help those families and those caregivers support their youth, their babies, to be successful, and to regulate some of the stressors and that the long-term stressors that can happen and how that impact on youth, how the impact on the babies.
Long-term stressors like what, Amy?
Well, so you had mentioned toxic stress earlier, and toxic stress is the reaction to chronic stressors that activate the body's stress response system. So that could be abuse, neglect. It could be economic instability in the home, family relational problems, chronic health issues, maternal depression, anything like that. So those are what we would refer to adverse childhood events.
Katie, you guys are focusing on kids, you know, 6 to 24 months old in an attempt to help develop coping mechanisms here. You know, I bet a lot of people out there didn't realize that you could influence a child's coping mechanism at such an early age here.
Yes, it's actually quite remarkable. So the way that the intervention is set up is very parent-directed. So every session is conducted in the family's home. It's all play-based. So the parent and child are playing together and interacting together positively the entire time that the intervention is happening. And the content that we're covering, the information that we're sharing, is kind of sprinkled throughout that interaction. But the focus is really on how is this parent interacting with this child in this moment, and how is that strengthening the attachment relationship that they have.
Katrina, what do we know about the dangers of elevated stress in babies? I mean, what does this wind up doing to a little one?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question, but I think long term, there's a lot of things that can happen. It can basically, an infant's brain is learning and it's taking in all this information. And if you don't use certain things, your brain naturally prunes the things you don't use. So if a child is constantly in this state of stress, and that's how their body learns to respond to everyday situations, that's how they're always going to respond. They don't learn what we would consider to be more healthy ways of coping, because their cortisol, it's kind of like you always have a car falling on top of you. And so you're constantly in that state of fight, flight, or freeze. And so it's really hard to function when you're constantly in that state.
Katie, how would you describe the types of families this project is focused on? How do you pick the people that you go into their homes and work with?
Mm-hmm. So this is a voluntary program. So any parent who is willing and able, if they meet the criteria, having a child between 6 months to 24 months, if they're willing to participate, we absolutely will work with them in ABC. And most of those families, I would say, as Amy mentioned, are experiencing a host of obstacles. So maybe economic hardship, maybe have relationship stressors, maybe parent and child have experienced maybe some traumatic events as well.
You know, Amy, I'm just guessing here, but the folks who volunteer readily for a program like this might not always be the types of families you ultimately want to reach here.
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that. Can you rephrase the question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, people who volunteer for a program like this, that's great, but I'm guessing that this program also is taking aim at families who might not voluntarily agree to participate in a program like this. It's the folks who aren't stepping forward that you might want to reach as well. And I'm wondering, how do you do that?
Well, we really want to reach any family that could benefit from the intervention and the increase in attachment between the child, parent, and the child. And so, you know, the agencies that are implementing the intervention, they are going out and seeking referrals from a lot of different places. And so that could be, you know, local pediatricians' offices. It could be from the local WIC agency. It may be from the mental health center. So really, the way we are going out and getting referrals is trying to go to a whole host of different type of agencies around a community in order to reach families in need.
Katie Hart, again, you're with Project Eagle in Wyandotte County. Weigh in here a little bit.
Yeah, so Project Eagle has a very robust intake and referral department, and that is where the majority of our ABC families come to us. So we have outreach in the community. We go to community events, health fairs, family events, and those are ways that we kind of let families know about all the services we offer.
You know, and we're talking, Amy, about a pretty intensive program here involving these home visitations that you guys have mentioned. Why is that so important?
Well, it's really important to be in the family's home, because that's where a family's going to be most natural, and that's where the coaches can really work with the parent in the natural environment, in, you know, with the toys, with the setting that is going to be most comfortable for the parents and the child. And so that's the importance of being in the home rather than an office setting, which is not a place where they are doing their parenting on a normal basis.
Katrina, how widespread is this problem of elevated stress among the babies of Kansas?
Well, you know, it's hard to know exactly, because you're talking about something that's happening within young children. but it can be pretty prevalent. You know, earlier, Amy talked about all those different things that can cause those stress levels to increase, which then leads to increased cortisol in all of us, not just in infants. So, I mean, if you think about some of those things that can cause those stressors, it's pretty widespread across the whole state.
Yeah. Can you actually look at a baby, Katrina, after having been in this program for a while, and can you spot a child that might be suffering from too much stress?
You know, I think there's things you can look at. You can look at the risk factors, which could be, as Amy mentioned, like economic instability, maternal depression, child abuse, child neglect. You can look at some of those things and kind of predict those things. You can also, you know, look at a child and a parent and see, you know, are they interacting with each other in a positive and healthy way? Do they know how to connect with each other? And I think that's the beauty of this program, is even if they don't know exactly how do I connect on that deep attachment level, this program brings them together.
Hmm. Katie, is that pretty apparent when a mom and a child isn't connecting? Can you tell?
That's hard to speak to directly, just because interaction between parents and children look a little different across the board. I would say to that question, though, you absolutely can tell from cortisol levels what that toxic stress looks like. So in typically developing children, cortisol production is really high in the morning and then gradually slopes downward throughout the day until they go to sleep. And children who experience toxic stress often have an elevated cortisol level that just stays at that elevated level throughout the day, which puts that child in high alert. They virtually have no opportunity for that system to relax.
How do you check that? How do you find out?
So that's not something that we would necessarily know other than testing their cortisol level.
Is that by blood withdrawal?
By saliva.
Oh, saliva. Mm-hmm. Okay. Amy, and then someone is suffering from undue stress as a baby. What happens to that child as he or she then grows older?
Yeah, well, we know that research has shown that toxic stress can lead to a whole host of issues later on in life. It's been linked to, lower high school graduation rates. It's been linked to mental health issues later in life, chronic health issues later in life, a whole host of different things like that, including I said mental health, depression, lost earnings in terms of job and higher education.
Are there short-term consequences as well, Amy?
Well, yes. Even when we think about the families in our study have a child between the ages of 6 and 24, but even thinking about like readiness going into grade school, elementary school, and developmentally thinking about language and and emotional development, which are important when you're thinking about going into kindergarten.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a new program that's underway across the state of Kansas. It's called Project Neuro Nurture. If you have a question about it and want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. How does one connect? Before I forget to ask this most basic question, Katie, how can one connect with this program at the local level here?
Sure. So I had previously mentioned our intake and referral department at Project Eagle, and that department is called Connections. And anyone who's interested in receiving services can call that department, and the number is 913-321-9999. And that's our Connections program.
We'll try to put that up on our website later on today. Amy, how did Kansas get involved with this program?
Sure. There was a researcher here at KU in the School of Social Welfare before me that was doing research related to the attachment biobehavioral catch-up intervention. ABC. And she did it at a few sites in Kansas, and there were promising results. And as a result of that, United Methodist Health Ministry Fund decided to pull together a collaboration of funders to fund more sites here in Kansas, which led to the current larger project with the 5 sites.
We have 5 sites across the state. How many sites would you like to have, baby, in a perfect world?
Oh, we would love to have it in, available in every county so that any family that was in need and that could benefit from ABC would have it within driving distance.
I was going to say, because you're talking about home interventions here, your ability to connect with lots of families is limited as a result. Is there a frustration level built in with that, Amy?
I think so. When you look at the number of families that can be served by these home visitors, this is intervention that has a lot of time involved in training and that sort of thing. And so the caseloads are small on purpose. And so they have a limited reach that each home visitor can have. And then when you add in driving distance for sites out in Western Kansas, it limits the number of families even more. And so, as I said, we would love to be all across Kansas in more agencies, more mental health centers, more early childhood centers.
Katrina, how many intervention specialists do you have in the Garden City area?
We have 3 who are trained, one who does it full-time and the other 2 who do it more on a part-time basis. But as Amy mentioned, we cover 19 counties. We can provide the intervention in 19 counties. And so there is a lot of drive time involved.
I was going to say, how many intervention folks, how many employees do you wish you had who could make these visits?
Well, in a perfect world, we would have a lot more that were more evenly spread out so that we could reach more families.
Do you have a waiting list of people in Garden City who are waiting to be served here?
We do. Right now, our waiting list is based more because the intervention is for 6 to 24-month-olds. Right now, actually, the people who are on our waiting list have infants who are under 6 months old. And so we're just kind of waiting for them to get to where they can participate.
How long is your waiting list?
Last time I checked, I think we had 4 or 5 on it. So it wasn't huge, but we are constantly working to get the word out more about ABC and to recruit and to extend our reach because we do cover 19 counties. We've had a lot that are closer to Garden City and closer to where our office is, but we definitely want to reach out more to those extended counties.
Katie, how about your waiting list in the Wyandotte County area?
So I actually, because I get my referrals from our intake department, I'm not necessarily privy to our exact waiting list at any given time. I'm a full-time ABC home visitor, so my caseload is kind of, referrals are brought to me whenever I graduate a family, and that kind of just keeps rolling.
Is there a trick here, Katie, with getting the word out to people to even understand that a program like this exists? Is publicity an issue? Marketing?
I think we benefit greatly from being a part of the Project Eagle agency as a whole. We have someone in our connections department who does outreach for all of our programs, and we've been lucky enough to kind of be included in that and offered as an option for families seeking services.
Amy, do you have an issue with getting the word out to enough families?
I think that at the beginning, there really was an issue in getting referrals at the 5 sites. I think that's improved as I mentioned, there is this collaboration of funders. And so our funders do a great job of getting the word out through presentations and such. And so have each of the sites have done presentations and media releases and that sort of thing. So I think at the beginning, it was pretty slow to get word out. But I feel like that has picked up quite a bit as we've been around the state with different presentations and media.
Yeah. Katie, what does the coaching look like? I mean, how do you train the parents of the kids you're working with? What's a typical home visit entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So each session, like the sessions take place in the family's home, like we mentioned, and each week of the program has like a defined parenting topic that we discuss. So some of those include the importance of like physically and verbally nurturing your child when they're distressed, maybe when they fall over, if they get hurt, the importance of a parent participating in child-directed play, and then really learning how to recognize and understand a child's emotions and then respond appropriately to them. So we use video clips, open-ended discussions, and play activities to really practice those skills that we're looking for. And then we also share research with parents about the benefits of doing things, these things with their child.
Yeah. And what's the biggest challenge that a lot of parents face?
I would say, kind of like we discussed earlier, a lot of families just have a lot of stressors going on. And raising an infant or a toddler is a very stressful experience in and of itself. And if you add all of these, add all these other, economic hardship or trauma into that, that makes parenting even more stressful.
Mm-hmm. Do you notice that a lot too, Katrina, the stress on the parents who are juggling 18 things these days as they try to raise a kid?
Oh, absolutely. I think, parents, simply the act of being a parent to an infant or toddler, none of us know exactly what we're doing. And so there's that whole piece. And then when you're juggling, jobs and childcare and a marriage or a partnership, all those different things. Yeah, there's just a lot of stress involved in the everyday tasks of raising a child.
Katrina, that was really a great point you just made. None of us really do know what the heck we're doing when a new child comes into the home. It becomes the most important thing in your life, and yet so many of us didn't really know what the heck we were doing.
Right. Yeah, one of the things our organization, Russell Child Development Center, that we really try to stress is to normalize that we all need help sometimes. None of us have it exactly figured out, and so that's part of a little bit of all of our programs that we offer. It's just that whole idea that, kids don't come with instruction manuals, and sometimes we all just need a little help figuring out what the best way to proceed is.
Yeah, Amy, what sorts of behaviors do you most commonly notice during home visits that maybe you'd like to see corrected as parents go forward with their kids?
Well, I think that, I think that some of the things that the home visitors focus in on are things like... like intrusiveness, thinking about how parents interact with the child, like too close or frightening behaviors, things that might frighten the child or startle, or maybe not frighten, but startle the child. Also thinking about responding to them in a positive way with like delight and happiness when a child does something that's successful, to show that positive reinforcement of, wow, you did it. I think being sensitive to the child's emotions. And so, if the child falls down, going and, picking the child up and, oh, did you hurt yourself? And so, those are the types of things that the intervention's really focusing in on, helping the parent further develop those skills.
Amy?
Yeah, and I think what makes this intervention so remarkable is that it's so positive. So the way that we teach these skills is not by saying, this is what you're doing wrong. We say, wow, that was so great when your child just fell over and cried and you went over there and scooped him up. They really were so comforted by your touch. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think makes this intervention so effective and so unique, is that we're really drawing upon parents' strengths.
Okay. Katrina, are there specific challenges facing families maybe out in rural Kansas that wouldn't be as common out here in the city or not?
Absolutely. That's kind of a constant crusade I'm on, is to educate people about risk factors about rural areas, because we are just simply so isolated. So one of the biggest things that comes to mind is when it comes to any kind of specialty medical or dental care. And by specialty, I mean developmental pediatricians, any kind of specialized treatment for kids, you're looking at least a 4-hour drive, more often a 6 to 7 hour drive. And sometimes, just because of the limited number of regular pediatricians that we have and dental providers, sometimes you have quite a drive just to go, take your child to a well child visit. You may drive an hour and 15 minutes just to do that piece of things, which when you have an infant or toddler, is pretty regular.
Mm-hmm. Amy, I'm wondering how open parents are to the tips and the work you do with them. What do you notice among the parents you work with?
I actually think that's probably a better question for the other two, since they're the ones that are interacting with the families more than I am as the evaluator.
Katie?
Sure. So I've seen that parents are very open and very enthusiastic in terms of participating and seeking feedback and things like that. Something that we use is video feedback. So we actually videotape our sessions, and then we're able to show parents, like, look at this great interaction you had with your child, which I think is really, really meaningful for them.
Yeah. Amy, this is a pilot program. Are there plans right now to expand it?
That is the hope. As I said, we really, really hope that we can secure funding from some source or another to expand into more parts of Kansas. And, you know, we just finished year one of the, this is a 3-year project, and we finished year one, and already as part of the evaluation, we've seen preliminary results that are very positive.
Katie, remind our listeners how they can connect with this program again here in the Metro.
Absolutely. They can contact Project Eagle's Intake and Referral Department, which is called Connections. And that phone number is 913-321-9999.
And we'll have that on our website after the show today. And if you're in Johnson County, can you connect with the program?
We actually do not have a site in Johnson County at this time.
Not yet, but it's maybe coming down the road, hopefully.
We don't know that.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. I want to thank Katie Hart with Project Eagle, home visitor, the Wyandotte County area, Amy Mendenhall, principal investigator for the program, and Katrina Lowry works with this program out in Garden City. Both Amy and Katrina joined us by Skype this morning. Thank you both very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yesterday, we heard about one couple's journey through the heartland and learned about the small town innovations they discovered there. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Missouri Auditor Nicole Galloway joins us for a discussion about whistleblowers, tax refunds, and student cybersecurity. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.